Back together again, you and I, midweek Wednesday style, July 19th, 2023, on Connecticut Today. We kicked off the show highlighting a controversy going on in the U.S. House involving New Haven area Democratic Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro. University of New Haven Senior Lecturer of Criminal Justice Ken Gray stopped by to talk about the Gilgo Beach serial killer investigation on Long Island. And Hearst, Connecticut columnist and editor Dan Haar dropped by for his weekly update. All right, so here we go, another day in paradise, another Wednesday, and another day that the Republicans in Congress insist on putting up ready-made campaign commercials for Democrats in 2022 and one of the 2024, I'm sorry. And one of these involves a member of Congress from Connecticut, 3rd District Democratic Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, who has been in Congress numerous years representing the, 13 or 16 towns or however many towns now. Some are partial towns, some whole in the greater New Haven area. And what am I talking about? Well, this happened yesterday, apparently while we were on the air, and it happened. And two things here that drive me nuts are rolled into one. Hey, I got a double shot, right? Right. It must have been two for Tuesday. Right. We got that yesterday instead of double shot Thursday, which usually comes up at every album rock station in the country. No, but seriously, two of my not so favorite things, amendments to bills that have nothing, zero to do with A, the process at hand, and B, stuff that you know you're already walking a political tightrope on. Again, this is not 30, 40, or 50 years ago when there was hardly any audio of any sessions of Congress or any video of sessions of Congress. These things, can be turned around in a nanosecond to make you look like Neanderthals. And again, the Republican Party, whether you like it or not, continues to receive blowback on this abortion stuff. Now, here's my point. I'll get to the specifics of what I'm talking about in just a second. But if we're going to go around and around about abortion and LGBT and all of this, at least keep it to the issue at hand. Don't get messed up in this over amendments here that are idiotic, that shoot yourself and your fellow Republican or conservative in the foot or in the back or in the head. It's ridiculous. Now, what am I talking about here? Now, follow along here. There was a debate in the House yesterday in the House Appropriations Committee. It wasn't the full House, but these are committee hearings, and you know how these things go. You have committee members saying, I want this in a bill, I need that in a bill, this shouldn't be in the bill, blah, 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 blah. All right, you folks are smart enough that when we talk about that on a national level and on a local level and on a state level, you kind of know what we're talking about here. Now, this has to do with a transportation spending bill, right? So the bill at hand here, now follow along and you'll see where I'm going with this. There's a transportation bill, or there was a bill yesterday that was up for debate in the House Appropriations Committee. This is usually really dry stuff. This is the kind of stuff that if you or I were sitting there either in person or we were watching this on C-SPAN, we wouldn't need Sominex. I mean, this is the kind of thing, and Mr. Chairman, on page 18 of this, and you and I be sitting there going, oh, yeah, I'm paying attention, I'm watching. It's the way my father used to say, don't turn the TV off, I'm awake. Okay, Dad. But for some reason, in the middle of a debate, thanks to Republicans, and let me remind you that I'm a registered Republican who would like to, win again. The Republicans had this degenerate into funding for LGBTQ centers around the country. Yeah, I know what you're saying. What do LGBTQ plus and whatever the acronym is, AA, whatever, I forget, IA, what does that have to do with transportation funding? And the answer is, ding, 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 nothing. But again, this drives me nuts. This is this amendment process that just, it makes my head explode. And both sides use it. Sometimes it's the side in power. Sometimes it's the side not in power. Sometimes they do this in Washington to kill a bill they don't like. Other times they do this in Washington to get a bill passed that somebody likes or doesn't like. I hate it. Some of these amendments are nuts. They have nothing to do with the bill, but they are allowed because of this archaic parliamentary procedure. Now, let me move on here. So, and I'm going to read you just a little bit here from a Politico article, and you'll see where our third district member of Congress, Rosa DeLauro, comes in. The clash, not the ban, the clash yesterday, sent the House committee into recess three separate times, okay? It broke out over a Republican amendment to the Transportation Department funding bill that would strip money from a handful of LGBTQ centers. So we're in a transportation committee hearing, like roads, bridges, infrastructure, this, that, and the other. And some of the folks who want this stuff passed in their districts got upset because there were amendments about LGBTQ centers there. The GOP amendment has been pitched, again, by a far-right member of the caucus, Representative Tom Cole of Oklahoma, who chairs the appropriations subpanel in charge of federal spending on transportation and housing, yada, 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 yada. His amendment would cut funding to three LGBTQ-focused community centers, one in Massachusetts, two in Pennsylvania. The amendment would also prohibit funding from being used to fly pride flags or take discriminatory action against anybody who speaks or acts in accordance with the belief that marriage is between one man and one woman. Now, remember, these are the Republicans who apparently want to lose elections. That's all I can see here. You're trying to push this through as an amendment to a transportation funding bill. You look like idiots. Seriously. The average person sees that, and millions of people are reading this story on Politico, and they're saying, well, wait a minute. What does this have to do with the transportation bill? Ah, Mom and Dad, the operative question. Representative Rosa DeLauro, Democrat, Connecticut, the ranking member on the House Appropriations Committee, called the GOP proposal a disgrace and compared it to negotiating with terrorists. Rosa wasn't happy yesterday. Republicans then call for DeLauro's terrorist comments to be struck from the markup record, and the proceedings formally paused. When the markup record resumed, she asked that her remarks be stricken. Okay, so maybe Rosa had a change of heart here. Later on, DeLauro said she has never opposed a Republican lawmaker's request for funding since she created earmarking 2 years ago. She said the projects were vetted and found to be eligible, adding that the only reason why they were stuck in because of the population it was serving, the LGBTQ community. Now, other Republicans said, no, we looked at these centers. One of them is communist. Oh, this is so stupid. This is so stupid. The amount of stupidity here is beyond pale. You are handing. And again, if you're a Democrat, you're sitting here going, you should have a good laugh over this. But if you're wondering, wonder along with me if you are. We have to wonder, where have the adults gone in the room that used to generally populate the Republican Party? And there's a conviction among some Republicans. Well, one of these, as I said, one of these centers was fostering this and fostering that. one of them was teaching communist ideology. Jeez. And again, you're trying to stick this stuff in underhandedly. And I'm sorry I have to say that. But you're trying to stick this stuff in underhandedly in a transportation bill? Come on, stop it. At least have the gulions, as my people like to say, the huervos, the castanets, the pecans, the walnuts, if you like, to do this in open Congress. Make it a standalone bill if you want to. Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Democrat Florida, earlier said the Cole Amendment proves Republicans don't like gay people. Well, sometimes perception is reality here. It's mind-boggling. It is again, the entire Biden presidency, the entire presence of him being in the White House is a batting practice fastball. And listen, I don't mind the Republicans commenting or wanting to do some stuff about social issues, but man, you got to watch it now. Because I'm reading stuff online, even from, you know, a variety of Republican strategists who say, hey, you got to have more than abortion here. You got to have more than LGBTQ here. And the biggest fear, the biggest chance Republicans are taking on this is they are at risk of alienating somebody or a lot of people who do have gay family members or friends. And again, I hearken remember years ago when conservatives and Republicans laughed at Democrats because they said, oh, these Democrats, all they care about are social issues. We're the party of strong defense, of the military being prepared, of taxes being collected and tax money being distributed freely after a lawful collection. We're the party of strong borders. How did that flip? Seriously, in the last 10 or 20 years, how did that flip? Does Kevin McCarthy have any control over his caucus? Inquiring minds want to know. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Right now, though, welcoming back one of our go-to folks when it comes to law enforcement, the big stories in the news regarding any law enforcement issues. We like to talk to this gentleman, among others. He's a retired FBI special agent with over 20 years of service. He's currently a senior lecturer, criminal justice, homeland security, and emergency management at the University of New Haven. Ken Gray is with us this afternoon. Hey, Ken, it's Paul. How are you, sir?
Hey, Paul, I'm doing great. Glad to be with you again.
Well, thank you, Ken. Appreciate that. Ken, give us your, before we get specific here, give us your macro view, your bird's eye view here of this investigation into this architect, this Rex Huerman, now facing charges in three killings, maybe a fourth or more, and he's being branded the Gilgo Beach serial killer. What are your initial thoughts on this, Ken?
So this is remarkable that they have, after over a decade, have come up with an alleged perpetrator for this murder, these murders. It's been over 10 years now that they've been looking for this, and it's only because they put together a task force and started looking at the evidence again that we have a suspect arrested now for this case. And I think we're going to find that instead of the Gilgo Four, that when they look at him and they look at the evidence of him and they look at what's around on his property, he may be actually good for a lot more than just four deaths.
You know, Ken, as to the testament, and you've talked about this before with me, some of these criminal profilers, I mean, there was a story, I don't know whether you saw this, and it may have been an FBI person, Ken Gray, but somebody said about 10 years ago, this is a white, professional, suburban man, probably married, probably with about two kids, probably is a high-income individual who more than likely probably works in New York City and lives near the area. I mean, this guy hit it with a bullseye, Ken.
Yeah, absolutely. That That is very, very accurate description of Rex Fuhrman in this case. Some of these things you could get through just regular statistics. That is, most serial killers are white males. Most serial killers start when they are in their late 30s, early 40s. You have to have a house somewhere because you can't kill somebody in an apartment, or it's very difficult to do the types of murders that he was doing mm-hmm. elsewhere. So some of these things fall into place just simply from statistics or from past cases. But nonetheless, that's a very accurate description. The thing about a profile is that it's very difficult to walk down the street as an investigator with that profile and say, that's the guy right there. It's useful after the fact to show that this is the right guy that you've gotten.
And Ken Gray, who's the guest from the University of New Haven right here on WICC. Ken, I guess as we read more and more about this, cell phone data and burner phones and messages and just running a whole lot of this together is a key factor here, correct?
Absolutely. So Ray Tierney, the Suffolk County District Attorney, has put an awful lot of information out there. We know through his press conferences and also by interviews that he's done with a number of different sources, a lot of details of this case, perhaps too much, in that by putting out all this information, he's trying his case in the press, and he's tainting the jury pool in the process. So I think that the case would be better served if we knew less details at this point, but you're absolutely right. Burner phones, DNA. Eyewitness descriptions, the car, being able to grab evidence from discarded pizza to show that his DNA is the same as that from a hair follicle found on one of the victims. These are all pieces of evidence that make it look very strong that Rex Fuhrman is the right guy. I'm waiting to see what evidence are found at the house.
Yeah.
We haven't heard what they pulled out of the house, except for the fact that he had over 200 guns inside of his house.
Yeah, and Ken, they say, though, that if you saw the same stuff I did in the New York papers, they say that he kind of thought they were on his tail, and he tried to stay a step or two ahead of them, maybe feeling over the past year or so, Ken, because I think they thought he was the guy, about a year and a half ago, and he may have sensed that.
So the task force was put together in January of 2022, and they quickly came up with him as the possible suspect. And so they started doing surveillance and started compiling all the evidence on him. But he was doing regular Google searches of his name and on information about the Go-Go murders so as to see whether or not law enforcement was on to him. Additionally, it looks like he was getting ready to become active again. There was one woman who made a police report about him approaching her in Brady Park, which really made her so nervous about the way this person approached her that she thought that he was somebody that she needed to report to the police. Turns out that it was Rex Fuhrman.
Ken Gray is the guest, Senior Lecturer of Criminal Justice, Homeland Security, and Emergency Management at the University of New Haven. So, Ken, I mean, obviously they're talking to him. What's the next step here? And you were an FBI agent, law enforcement for years. Do they just sit this guy down and say, look, Rex, we have you here? Now, whether they do this without an attorney or not, you're in deep trouble here. Just tell us about the other killings. Do they try and tell him, Ken? Do they work him into a situation? It's not like, did you do anything? We know you did, Rex, so let's make it easy on the families here. Is that something they do?
Well, that looks good on TV, but in actuality, as soon as you lawyer up, your lawyer is going to tell you not to talk to the police.
Mm-hmm.
So your only chance of having that work is at the initial arrest or prior to the arrest if you're interviewing the person before you arrest them. Once they lawyer up, the lawyer is going to say, don't talk to the police. And so that opportunity is passed. Now, but this is an active investigation. I say it's an active investigation because there may be other cases out there. There may be other districts. There may be other states that have victims that he might be responsible for. So now that he is the known suspect in the Gilgo 4, they're going to be checking with other districts, with other jurisdictions to see if they have unsolved murders that he might be good for. So this investigation is by no means over. There's still a very active investigation going on.
And Ken, finally, you alluded to this a couple of seconds ago. Is his attorney going to push here for a change of venue, saying, my God, my client's been tried on every radio talk show and newscast in the country. How can he get a fair trial?
That's my thoughts exactly, is that there has been so much detail put out, so much that the district attorney has put out in the interviews and in press, that the lawyer for Huerman is going to have a very strong argument to ask for a different venue, to go to a different district to have this tried in. Because how can the jury pool is tainted? Everybody has heard about this, so he can make a very strong case that his client cannot have a fair trial there in New York.
Ken Gray, always good to hear from you. Ken Gray, longtime FBI veteran, 24 years in the Bureau, currently a senior lecturer, criminal justice, homeland security, and emergency management at the University of New Haven. Ken, good to speak with you, and I'm sure we'll speak on this case and others down the line. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Paul.
Appreciate it. There you go. All right. Yes. How do you get an impartial jury on this case? Now, what people probably say, well, yeah, people have heard of it, but they'll ask jurors, can you be impartial on this? And they'll do that, what's called the voir dire, during the jury selection process until they get 12 men or women and however many alternates they need as well. Our regular, though, Wednesday meetup with Dan Haar right now, columnist, editor, Hearst Connecticut Media. Dan, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Good afternoon. Nice midsummer day.
Yeah. Tolerable, I would say. And a lot of stuff to talk about, Dan. Earlier in my show, I said kudos to Governor Lamond here, Dan, at least in my opinion. I don't know how you feel about it. The governor confronting this so-called bogus ticket information story here, and he's saying he's bringing in an outside entity to take a look at all this.
That's a good step. He's been under pressure from, frankly, my colleagues, rightly, at Hearst Connecticut Media, where we first reported Bill Cummings and some others on the investigative team there, that these tickets, I think it's a little bit of a misnomer to call them tickets, because what they were, they alleged, according to the allegations, wanted to make them, untraceable. What they were really reporting was warnings, right? So I think people have the impression that they're reporting that people got tickets, as in you get a ticket for speeding. But it was when you get stopped by a state trooper and you get a warning that says, well, you were going 4 miles over the speed limit, drive safer, and, I don't want to see you again. That's what was being reported as happening and didn't happen.
And it makes you wonder, Dan, I mean, what was the reason? I guess we'll find out. Was this to make it look like troopers were actually doing something? I've been reading this over and over, and you said your coverage of this has been excellent, Dan. I'm still trying to figure out what the point of this was.
To be clear, my colleague's coverage, I haven't weighed in on this. And when I do weigh in, what I'm going to say is that, look, if something is – three or four, I believe it was four troopers initially that were accused of this, that records showed were doing this. That's on them, right? But if you've got, 20, 30% of a force that's doing the same thing, then the issue becomes much broader and much more about the institution and less about the individual troopers, because something that's being done that's wrong by a large number of people at an institution speaks to cultural issues and institutional problems. And that's what I think the investigators need to look at, not just who did what, but what were the conditions that led to it. Presumably that's what the governor's outside group is going to find.
We got some interesting news today from a rather prominent Connecticut university regarding admissions as well.
Yes, Wesleyan University, my alma mater. I did not get in there through legacy. I had no family members there. I probably wouldn't get in today. That was some decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, and as we've discussed, standards are much tougher for millennials for a variety of reasons. But yes, Wesleyan said no more legacy admissions. And the big caveat there, meaning that if you have a relative who went there, that's not going to help you get in. Presumably, unspoken is even if the relative has given us a lot of money. And that's where the rubber meets the road. It's easy to say there's not going to be admissions favorable treatment if you had a parent or an aunt or an uncle or a cousin or a brother or sister who went there. But if your family has given them $1 million, do you get preferential treatment? The implication is the answer is no. And you know, these are things that are hard to track because they're one-offs, right? Who's to say?
Yeah.
And we all know, you know, that there are names of families associated with every university. And if those names occur in the freshman class, it's to nobody's surprise. On the other hand, maybe those kids are very, very, very outstanding, more than qualified, and have mm-hmm. grown up under the standards that they're upholding. I don't, you know, it's a very hard thing to tease out. And of course, this is related to the Supreme Court decision
sure.
on affirmative action.
And Dan, I think one of the pluses of this story, even though some people are upset with what the Supreme Court did, Dan, is at least it's casting now, I think, a needed spotlight on legacy admissions, on the college admission process. We found out specifics in that story about how Harvard was using race, how NC, North Carolina was using race and the other factors. Because, Dan, I don't know about you, but I had never really read anything in depth previously about the actual nuts and bolts of the admissions process and how all this worked. It was always kind of shrouded in mystery.
Well, it remains shrouded in mystery. It's one of the great black boxes, along with, for example, the energy market. You know, when you buy electricity, it's no longer, of course, generated by Eversource and United Illuminating the way it was when we were kids. It is now generated by outside merchant generators, and it's a black box. The admissions college and elite institutions, elite colleges and universities, is also a black box. It's you don't know exactly what's going on. A former colleague of mine from more recently with the New York Times
mm-hmm.
wrote a book called The Gatekeepers about the Wesleyan admissions process in an effort to demystify it. But it is by nature mystical because mm-hmm. you're making decisions about individuals. As Michael Roth, the president of Wesleyan, said today in the memo, we have always at Wesleyan taken a holistic and individual approach to who we admit. Wesleyan can afford to do that. It's a small university with 3,200 students total, not per year, but total.
Yeah.
And so they can look more individually and holistically. Larger universities have to be much more empirical, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. And Dan Haar, this whole scenario with the Stone Academy here and how we get more and more information on this and the state pointing a finger at the owner and the owner's finger going back. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people caught in the middle on this.
Well, 800 students are caught in the middle, and it's tragic because they spent years of their lives in this training to become nurses, and it does not look today's. What happened today was the release of the judgments about which transcripts, which courses were valid and which were not. And a very high percentage of the clinical work that was done was ruled invalid, meaning those students can't take those courses, those clinical credits elsewhere. And the Stone Academy, through lawyers, is saying, well, the state shut us down, and they could have had a more orderly process and in which we completed work so that these students were able to get the credits they earned in due time, right? So today was sort of a tragic revelation. Much of the coursework was ruled invalid. The state is still going to try and do placement of people at either Lincoln Tech or Griffin Hospital,
mm-hmm.
where they do nursing training. And hopefully it'll work out for as many of these students as possible, but there's no way to make up years that were lost. On one of the TV stations, Derek Slapp, the senator from West Hartford,
sure.
said, we're going to try and compensate people for the time they spent. But how do you do that?
Yeah, and again, you do that, Dan Harding. You open up Pandora's box, maybe, to some other complaints here. And I was wondering whether you in any reporting at Hearst or you yourself or spoken to anybody, what about the veracity? You mentioned them, Dan, a couple of seconds ago, of the Stone Academy attorneys who say, hey, this is the state's fault, not ours. Are they just saying that to put up some sort of a diversion here? Or might they have a claim there? Or we don't know.
Well, I mean, what they're saying is the state went about shutting down Stone Academy in a very ham-handed way that did not preserve the what could have been preserved in the efforts of those students. Say, for example, if a class was almost done or had been done improperly, if you shut the place down, they can't make it right for the rest of the semester. You're just shut down at that point. And, you know, the state is in a little bit of a tough position, damned if you do and damned if you don't. If they let the place stay open, they're going to be accused of allowing an operator that has serious allegations or perhaps in some cases proven allegations against them move to sort of let that move forward. And you shouldn't do that. And if they do what they did, you're going to be accused of not treating the students as well as they could. It's a little bit like way back English Station in New Haven, the power plant. I'm doing two power plant analogies. They wanted to convert it to green energy, but they had to run it dirty with coal to pay for the conversion. And everybody said, no.
I remember that. Good stuff. Yeah. Dan Haar, as always. Dan Haar, his Wednesday spotlight here, Hearst, Connecticut Media. Dan, be good. Have a good weekend. We'll talk to you next week, sir. Thank you.
Great to be here.
Appreciate it, Dan Haar. Yeah, that's a... Man, I hope you don't have a son or a daughter or grandson or granddaughter or a wife or a husband caught up in that Stone Academy scenario. What did Dan say? 800, 900 people just in limbo that found out that some of their credits are not transferable. Oh, man. And I was thinking about that earlier today. Could they be made whole? W-H-O-L-E, not H-O-L-E. Could they be made whole? Is there ways that these students can get compensated for the thousands of dollars or not? That's sad. And I guess the lesson you learn from this is if you're going to go to a for-profit college or one of these instructional schools, check the background. They're not all bad. Some of them are very good. But just be careful as to what you or any of your relatives is doing.